Coming up, got Tom Haverstraw talking about Minnesota and OKC game two. OKC went up 2-0 in that series. And then I bring on Jonathan from Knicks Film School. We broke down, boy, the Knicks blowing the most unthinkable lead against the Indiana Pacers in game one. And we looked ahead to game two and the rest of that series. Later in the show, talked with Ace Newell, potential lottery pick in the 2025 NBA draft. That's all coming up right now. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. The Oklahoma City Thunder just beat the Minnesota Timberwolves 118-103 in game two of the Western Conference Finals. We'll talk about it. Tom Haverstraw. What up, Tom?
Hey, just get my Scott Foster on, making sure we're ready for the show.
Yep. I did not know that was coming. You just put this in now. He didn't see it coming from Lou Dort either, did he?
No, just physicality, man. It's at another level, and you just want to be prepared. So Scott Foster, me, we're just trying to endure the postseason, no matter whether Lou Dort or whether you, Kev, you're giving me an errant elbow here, inadvertent, doesn't matter. I'm ready to play.
Well, I'll tell you what, Tom. Unfortunately, Minnesota's also got a bloody nose after this game too as well. They're down 2-0 in the series now. They score 103 in game two after being held to just 88 in game one. SGA had 38 points in game two tonight. I'm not seeing a lot of reasons for optimism here with Oklahoma City, Tom. I talked after game one on my pod about it just feels like OKC is on a different level. Anthony Edwards needs to level up his play as well. All the talk about SGA and the grifting and all that was ignoring what we're seeing with this team on the defensive end of the floor, becoming an all-time great defense. What do you think, Tom? Are there any reasons to feel like Minnesota can make this an actual competitive series based off what you've seen through the first two games so far?
No, there's no good signs here. There's nothing you can point to and say, look, they're doing good things. The process is right. They're just not getting the results. You can say some of the three-pointers are not going down, the open threes, but the DNA of this Minnesota team is that they play swarming defense. They're going to turn you over. They're going to be huge with Rudy Gobert and with Julius Randle and Naz Reid. And if anything, they're the softer team. If anything, Rudy Gobert can't be played in this series. He's not making an impact. How many times in this series have you seen Rudy Gobert get the ball on the move and have some totally just JV basketball play at the rim? It doesn't look like he deserves to be out there offensively because he's not getting the second chance points. He's not asserting himself in those screens and laying guys out. I mean, I'm not trying to put this all on Rudy Gobert because Julius Randle was benched in the fourth quarter along with Dante DiVincenzo. But it's not a good sign, Kevin, when your huge trade, when you trade Karl Anthony Towns, the two guys you get back in that trade are benched in the fourth quarter at game two. Mm. It was a horrible game for those two guys. Dante DiVincenzo, minus 47 in this series when he's on the floor. The Minnesota Timberwolves have been outscored by 47 points when Dante DiVincenzo is on the floor. So they lose last year. They come back with a new look with Julius Randle and Dante DiVincenzo, and Chris Finch lost all faith in those guys in game two, and I can understand why, man.
DiVincenzo, what happened to the dude with these banger performances last year for the Knicks in the postseason? Game one against the Pacers, or game six against the Sixers, 23 points. Game one against the Pacers, 25. Game two, 28. Game three, 35. Game seven against the Pacers, which was a loss for the Knicks, 39 points. Where's that guy for the Minnesota Timberwolves right now? They'd love to have him make a comeback, but Tom, You're right. You're right about Rudy. He's not offering him anything offensively for Minnesota. He's not able to impose his will like he did earlier in each series throughout against Hartenstein and against Chet Holmgren. He doesn't have that effect. Julius Randle, a dud tonight from him after a really good game one. And then Mike Conley. I mean, I don't want to knock on the guy, 37 years old. You can't expect a lot from him. But 2 of 8 in game one, 1 of 6 in game two from a guy who is starting and getting 25 minutes per game for you. It's hard. Like, I think with SGA and Anthony Edwards, they are both two of the four or five or six or seven best players in the league, depending on where you want to rank. Anthony Edwards, SGA is better. Well, we can talk about that. But for Anthony Edwards, the supporting cast is nowhere near what SGA has. That is without question for Ant with this situation right now. Whereas you look at Jalen Williams, the big game he had tonight, not only 26 points for Oklahoma City, not only 10 rebounds and 5 assists, but excellent, versatile, timely defense as well. So, like, just his second star, the bench guys, Lou Dort, the timely strips on Randall. It's just up and down the roster. Like, you could go on forever with OKC compared to Minnesota. I don't see a lot of reasons for optimism either, Tom. I just don't. I can't find any.
Dude, it looks like OKC has six defenders out there sometimes. They're that good. Defensively, yeah. I've talked about it. It's the best defense I've ever seen. Like, when they're getting guys
you
in isolation.
You said that early in the year, Tom. You were on that super early with OKC.
It's just they play at another level. They play with a physicality. They play with a chemistry. It seems like they always know where their teammates are, and they have size. They have smarts. They know when to attack, when to kind of hit the gaps and make sure to wall up. And then the other thing is their defense turns into offense. I'm going to give you a stat here. In this series, the points off turnovers margin, OKC has 53 points off of turnovers, and Minnesota has 20. Okay.
Dude,
thank you, Stat Muse. I had that written in my notes here, but look at that graphic. Fantastic job here. I have it. I promise you, I had this written down. I am not cribbing it off of Stat Muse, but that's the story of the series. Like, the defense is insane. Yeah. The half court offense for Minnesota, they can't get anything good. In the half court, their points per possession in the first game of this series was at 81. In the second game, it's 95. This OKC defense held the Denver Nuggets 12 points below where they were in the first series. Denver scored 115 points every 100 possessions in the first series. And against OKC, that went down to 103. So when you're looking at Minnesota heading into this series, 112. They're probably going to be around 92, 95 points per 100 possessions against this OKC defense. It's just, it's insane. It really is insane when you watch how they play. The play of the game, J-Dub in the fourth quarter, he swipes the ball, puts it behind his back, kicks it up, and then when he gets the and one, you're just looking at yourself like, they turn defense into offense better than any team. And when they get as many turnovers as they do, more turnovers than we've seen in the play-by-play era, this team is on another level, like you said at the top of the show, Kev.
Tom, and I think, you know, when you talk about turning defense into offense, so much of that, I mean, it's skill level of the players, but the game planning as well. Like, there was this play last round against Denver, and the play I mentioned tonight, when Lou Dort stripped Julius Randle under the basket, he probably didn't reestablish himself in bounds before outletting it. And SGA drew an and one, and it looked like a legitimate foul in transition. But it just reminded me of a play last round when Cason Wallace, like, perfectly timed a rotation on Nikola Jokic after they trapped Jamal Murray around the free throw line, and he swiped down, like, at the perfect moment to get the ball out of Jokic's hand. How many times did we see that last round against Joker? How many times are we going to see it throughout this round against Ant and Julius Randle and everybody at Minnesota? This is from game planning. This is showing film and saying, this is the moment to be there. This is the moment to swipe. This is the moment to make a play and just cause havoc for this offense in situations that they're not expecting it. It is a combination of skill and game planning with what we see from OKC all year long, and they're turning it up to another level in this postseason when you see stuff like that. It's absolutely unbelievable what Oklahoma City is doing on the defensive end. And for Anthony Edwards, Tom, like, it's going to be a puzzle for him, like, a huge learning experience. SGA, 3 years older than Ant, far more advanced on his drives to the basket, far more advanced as a decision maker. SGA, significantly better at this point of his career. That is not a knock against Ant, who's only 23 years old, who has a lot of room to grow. This series has shown it, though. I thought game two, he was a lot better than game one, because game one, Ant, man, he's like only 13 shots, first of all. Only 13 shots was not enough, but he only had one shot in the paint only one shot in the paint. Game two tonight, 26 total shots, 11 shots in the restricted area. The tracking stats have not come out yet from Synergy, but he had only 7 drives in game one to 28 for SGA in game one. I'd imagine Anthony Edwards more than doubled the drives into the paint in this game too. So that's encouraging, but there's just not as much room for him. He's still not as skilled at finishing at the rim as SGA, still not as skilled at drawing fouls for that matter either. If you want to call it a skill, I know people don't want to talk about that with SGA, but it is.
People like to talk about it, Kev. People like to call it. They love to talk about it. Yeah, not very complimentary terms, but they love to talk about it.
No, dude, I had Trey Johnson, top 5 pick in the NBA draft in all likelihood, on my pod this week. And I posted the clip on my socials this week. I asked him, and I always ask the same question to all the draft prospects. I was like, if you could download any move into your brain and have it immediately from any player in NBA history, what would it be? Last year, I asked Victor Wembanyama that. He's like, the way KD moves off ball, the hesitation with the way he moves off ball. You ask other guys, they're like, oh, you know, Luka's step back, the Harden step back. Trey Johnson says, whatever it does that SGA does to draw fouls, like whatever SGA is doing. And I was like, grifting? He's like, yeah, the grifting move. So that's, there were so many like OKC fans that replied to that. They're like, ooh, I love Trey Johnson now. And then he had a bunch of other people like, this, I hate this guy. These kids learning from SGA. It's like, dude, no, SGA learned from Dwayne Wade. This is not a new thing. This is a very old thing. But yeah, anyway, I digress here, Tom.
Yeah, if you want more on this, watch The Big Number this week. We did it with Dan Devine, came out on Thursday. The numbers on SGA just don't measure up to all of the great scorers of all time. The stat is that he has had 9.2 free throw attempts per game, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander this postseason, which over a 12-game span, that total of 110 free throw attempts over a 12-game span and ranks 6th all time. 406 in the postseason. So, like, if you look at Dwayne Wade, if you look at Kobe, if you look at MJ, if you look at LeBron, you look at Paul Pierce, Manu Ginobili, they've all gotten way more free throws than what we're seeing with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. And you know what? Tonight is the first time that he's had back-to-back games with at least 10 free throws this postseason. So it's not like he's on that Dwayne Wade run where he's getting 20 free throws, or even Dirk Nowitzki was getting 20 plus free throw attempts. We haven't seen that from SGA yet. And yet people are just really upset because I think, look, man, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, the way he moves laterally, the way he snakes into the defense, the way his hesitation, his pacing, he might not have the fastest or the quickest first step, but he might have the quickest fifth step we've ever seen in the NBA. The way that he lulls you into thinking that you've got him and you've got, you know, staying in front of him, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander just waits until you get your foot out in front of you, the weight off balance, and he is, boom, gone. And he's going to get into you and make sure that he draws contact and finishes. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is incredible. He's an incredible scorer. And I'll say this, Anthony Edwards, too little too late, man. Like when I watched this game, the third quarter, when the game started getting away from Minnesota, there were 3 straight possessions, Kev, where Anthony Edwards was staying half court as a decoy, having Lou Dort face guarding him. And Anthony Edwards wanted nothing to do with the play. I don't know whether this was by design or whether this was just he was tired. He had 18 field goal attempts in the first half, Anthony Edwards did. That is a career playoff high. I don't think he's ever had 18 field goal attempts at halftime in his career. And he was coming out, trying to get post-ups, trying to get action. But in that third quarter, when OKC went on that big run, Ant just kind of gave up and he lost his spirit, whether it was about Julius Randle and his play, whether he looked at his teammates and was like, you know what, you guys try it. I'm not gonna keep doing this anymore. And yes, he made that fourth quarter run and he was awesome in the fourth quarter. But the game was lost in the third quarter and Ant just didn't do enough.
One of the things I think Minnesota needs to do with Ant more off the catch, and this is partially on him too. You're talking about giving up in certain possessions. I think he needs to trust sometimes that the ball is gonna find him again. But so far in this postseason, he has taken 75 3-point jumpers off the dribble, made only 28% of them. He's taken only 31 3-pointers off the catch. he's made 58.1% of them. So he's taken only 31 threes off the catch to 75 threes off the dribble. Too much off the dribble, not enough off the catch when he's such a lethal shooter. He was a lethal shooter, one of the best shooters all season long, still has been in this postseason. You got to find that guy for more shots. Whether that means a Mike Conley, Rudy Gobert, high pick and roll, kick out to Anthony Edwards, or whether it means Julius Randle, post out, kick out to Ant, whatever it is, the ball needs to find Anthony Edwards in these easy situations off the catch. And also, Tom, that's what could also lead to him, if they're closing out hard on him, driving that closeout, getting to the basket, putting the defense into rotation. So I think that's part of it here with Ant is trusting that you'll get the ball back, and also for his teammates to look for this guy and get him the ball back. And I don't think a lot of the time that they're necessarily doing that, but that's also just partially the nature of Minnesota's offense. But there's these little things here with Minnesota that I'm like, yeah, you know, there's a shot, like there's a chance they could win some games in this series. I picked OKC in six. I feel like it's more likely going to be five at this point. But a sweep wouldn't shock me either. I don't think that's outrageous to say, but ultimately, like, this is another year. I think just like last year, Ant comes back, one of the best shooters in basketball. This is another year, 23-year-old Anthony Edwards, where it's looking like, okay, how can I get better so I can take the next step next year? And that's just, I'm predicting that's going to be the main takeaway. And I don't think that's some hot take at all. It's probably actually just a cold take to say that this is going to be the case for Anthony Edwards this year.
I mean, it's increasingly a young man's league. This is increasingly a young man's game. Like when you're looking at Rudy Gobert and Mike Conley in this series, they just look old. Like Rudy Gobert, how many times have you seen Rudy Gobert look like he is the biggest, strongest guy out on the floor? On offensive rebounds, how many times has he gotten a lob in the half court against OKC? I can't remember like any times. And there's times where he gets the ball in that short roll and then throws it off the backboard. I mean, I don't know where they're going to go with Rudy Gobert, dude, but like that 27-point, 24-rebound game against the Lakers to close out the Lakers, that feels like 10 years ago, dude. Like
it feels like last night for me. You see the jersey over my shoulder. Feels like yesterday.
No, come on. Come on, dude. Come on, dude.
I'm like, joking.
Rudy.
I'm joking. I know. Dude, I can be fair. I can be fair and honest with Rudy Gobert.
If you're going to play that guy, he has to get that second chance of opportunities for and sure. to kick out to shooters, or he's going to have to get some sort of separation for Anthony Edwards and getting him downhill and finishing at the lob. They've got nothing from him. And look, it's just not his series. At this point, when you're looking at Chet and Hart, way that they have been rebounding the ball and not allowing Rudy Gobert to assert himself, this is just a bad series for he and Julius Randle. This was the thing. If Julius Randle thinks he can get bully ball against the Golden State Warriors and against the Los Angeles Lakers, it's a different ball game with OKC. It's not going to work. And Chris Finch pulled the plug on Julius Randle in game two. And look, he's been on such a good run here in the postseason. A career low 6 points on 2 of 11 shooting is not going to cut it. And they need more from Julius Randle. And if you're looking at the game three game plan, do you start Naz Reid? Got a lot better actions, a lot more assertive, a lot more sound, both ends of the floor. We've been calling for that all season long, and I don't know if Chris Finch is going to do that. You might lose Julius Randle for the series if you do that. But Naz Reid, man, he looked a lot better next to Anthony Edwards. Like that flip, that switch went off for Anthony Edwards without Julius Randle on the floor. I wonder if you can read into that.
Maybe. I mean, like Julius Randle's been so good. Like it's a hard decision to make, and you know Naz has his flaws defensively as well, but you know if he's shooting the ball well, like Randle did in game one, Randle did really shoot well in game one. Maybe that's something you go to more often. I wonder if also, you know, if you're talking about series adjustments, whether it's lineups or something tactical, we saw Minnesota try out some zone in this game, didn't work well. OKC looked very well prepared for that. It did force them to take more threes than they did in game one. when OKC took the fewest frequency of threes that they did throughout the entire postseason versus Minnesota that took the most threes they had the entire postseason. But OKC game one, Minnesota didn't use zone. Game two, Minnesota's using some zone in addition to their center defense. Late in the game, they blitzed, they trapped SGA. You can't do that all game long. But I do wonder if maybe that's something Minnesota goes to after their success in that fourth quarter, try to get the ball out of SGA's hands. They had a possession where they forced the ball to Dort late ISO. Like, that was the best shot OKC had in the possession. I wonder if maybe that's something you go to, but I feel like OKC's going to be ready for that. I just don't see many answers, but I just would imagine that's something you'll see Minnesota try earlier in games instead of when they're down late in the fourth.
SGA is just too good, man.
He's amazing.
He's amazing. So good. He makes the right decisions.
For a reason, Tom. He was rightfully named the MVP.
Right, Michael Malone? He was just on my screen just a second ago with SVP. So,
Malone clarify that before the game? Just so everybody knows, Jokic would have been my vote for MVP. It's like, dude, you also said OKC has the best home fans. That's what you also said. It wasn't just that's why SGA is the MVP. He 2 hours earlier in the night, he said OKC is the best fans. It's like, come on. You're being petty, oh, just like man. You were, always were. It's part of who you are. It's part of why you're great. It's part of why Nuggets fans are also mad at you right now. It's just the reality of it. You don't have to backtrack. Oh, it's okay. Man. Oh, yeah. Oh, Jokic was okay with you getting fired. It's okay to feel petty. It's okay. Jokic did not.
I had no idea
you.
That he did a mea culpa after
the
game.
Yeah, he did. He's like, just so everybody knows, there's a lot of people mad at me. The other ESPN
broadcasters. He's got to have a thick skin. He's been coaching in this league for a long time. He knows he's got to have a thick skin, especially in media, man. Michael Malone. I think he's got good analysis. He's been doing a good job.
Tom, here's the thing. He doesn't have thick skin. He can't handle being called Mike Malone.
Yeah, it's kind of true. Yeah, that's why I keep saying Michael. I don't want to piss him off. You know,
get a you call.
Yeah, I did vote for Nikola Jokic for MVP this year. If I had a vote, what I want to make sure the people of Denver know that because I'm getting a lot of heat back home.
Come on,
let it go.
Relax.
Let it go, Mike. Mike.
Oh God, it's so silly. Did you know, Tom? Speaking about the broadcast tonight, did you know Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Nikhil Alexander-Walker are cousins?
Get out!
I know.
Oh, so that's the cousin that they've been talking about every 6 second in this series. Oh, okay.
You know what it reminds me of? During the NFL draft. They have the NFL draft broadcast on ESPN with like Mel Kiper and hardcore analysis. And then they have the family channel one on ABC, the ABC version of the NFL draft where it's all about family and happy stories and sad stories. And they talk about stuff like that. It's like, we don't need that so often on this broadcast. Save it for like the family channel version of this broadcast, if that exists somewhere. We don't need it from Breen and Doris and RJ this often on the main broadcast.
I mean, they're trying to find some storylines here because the audience, the national audience, is not really familiar and acclimated with this OKC team. Even though they won 68 games, they were not the number one or number two or number three team in national TV appearances. So they're trying to make up for lost ground here, making the stories about OKC. I've been talking about it all season long, is this team should have been, along with Wemby, on national TV at every opportunity, because this is the future. Team's average age is 24 years old. 24. Like, they and Auburn are not that much in terms of average age. This is just the beginning. And so I feel like we need to put the work in to watch these guys, these young players, with a little bit more attention on the national stage. And so now we're kind of playing catch up, and the Nikhil Alexander-Walker stuff, That feels like, man, we've got to find some storylines to like get the jaws, the fangs into the audience on a national level. Because the SGA stuff, there's a vacuum here, a void of people are trying to find something to complain about with this OKC team. And if it's just the free throw attempts that rank 406th all time, I mean, we got to find something else. I think the audience is trying to figure out what we're doing in this post Kevin Durant, Stephen Curry, and LeBron James era. And so I think what you're seeing is indicative of us trying to figure out storylines to get the national audience and kind of pit some enemies or some sort of drama. And outside of some Nikhil Alexander Walker fouls against Shea, I kind of liked those. There's just not much there to go off of when you haven't been cultivating these stories all season long.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I do think that's fair. That's definitely a part of it with like looking for stories here. I would imagine if OKC makes the finals, that's when I hope you'd hear a lot more different stories. I don't think it, maybe I've missed it. Sometimes I watch parts of games on mute. I don't think they've mentioned Dagnall and Caruso being on OKC Blue together years back. You know, okay, Caruso before he was fully bald. I mean, and Dagnall looking younger with a terribly fitting suit. That classic picture that you see in social of those two sometimes. There's a lot of layers, you know, to a lot of these guys on the OKC team with and their journeys. Like I said, Hartenstein, like such a slow start to his career before finding himself with the Clippers and the Knicks and now with the Thunder. There's a lot of different guys that have different paths to get to this point. And, you know, I think we talked a lot about their defense earlier, Tom. I thought it was nice today that two of their players were rewarded with the all-defensive team honor. You saw Mobley, Daniels, Draymond, Thompson, and Dort get named to first team all-defensive, and then Zubats, Triple J, Tumani Kamara, Rudy Gobert, and Jalen Williams from OKC all were named to the second team. So two OKC players named to the all-defensive team. Overall, whether it's OKC or any of the other names, minus Tumani Kamara. Any takeaways from the all-defensive teams, Tom, including Tumani Kamara? I'm just joking, yeah.
Yeah, dude, I love Tumani. You know that.
Oh, he's awesome. He's so good.
I was glad to see that he got second team all defense. And look, when you're out competing with Draymond and Evan Mobley and the rest of the first team, it's going to be hard to beat them in terms of the reputation and what Amen and Dyson Daniels did this season. Outstanding. Lou Dort deserves it. I would say Evan Mobley and what we saw in the postseason, I wasn't a big fan of him being the defensive player of the year this year. I thought it was Amen Thompson. I might not have had him, Evan Mobley, in my first team all defense. That's probably the only thing, maybe Jaden McDaniels over Jalen Williams. I understand that they want to get as many OKC teams on there, considering this was one of the best defenses we've ever seen this season in the regular season. The postseason, it is the best defense we've ever seen. Looking at their defensive rating compared to the league average this postseason, no defense in postseason history has gotten this far by being that much better than average on the defensive end. And so I understand why two OKC guys are on that. I don't know. It feels like Caruso. I feel like the minimums on this, I don't know. Jalen Williams wouldn't have been my pick at number two, but I understand why they had him.
Understandable. I had Jalen Williams on mine. Quick note on Kamara. A couple of weeks back, maybe a month or so back, you remember I gave away the Tumani Kamara Belgian waffles mix, right? I gave out two of them. The Blazers sent me two because we thought one got lost in the mail. So I gave out two of them with a random giveaway on social. One of the people received it. I'm sure very happy. I hope they made and enjoy their waffles. Ryan, if you are listening or watching, look in your DMs. I have your Tumani Kamara waffles right here. Ready to ship. Ryan, check your DMs. Check. I'm asking for your address so I can ship you your Tumani Kamara Belgian waffles. Check your DMs, please. I want to send them your way. You won.
Yeah.
You won, Ryan. Ryan T. Ryan T. They're ready to ship out to you.
Come on, Ryan. Let's go. Let's go.
Let's go, Ryan. Anything else in the news, Tom? We miss anything else? SGA won MVP. All defensive team came out. Anything else this week that we missed?
Oh, we did see the Nuggets hired a coach or got an extension.
Yes, that's right. Yes, that's right. David
Who's
Adelman
running the show there?
Hired.
Adelman got the extension, but is it Kroenke? Is the acting GM here?
I do think the Kroenkes really running the show. And I'll tell you what, if Minnesota gets swept here by OKC or loses in five, it sure as hell does make what Denver did all the more impressive. So, you know, I understand Adelman getting that opportunity. I do.
Yeah. And Michael Malone, it seems like he might be in the running for some other jobs, maybe potentially this season. He's done a pretty good job in his short stint so far on ESPN. But Adelman,
I like him. Look, I like Malone as a broadcaster. I like him. I think he could be really good.
Yeah, yeah. And Adelman, I like him too in this position. You know, they're not making this hire without Jokic's blessing, right? In both directions of Malone out and Adelman in. I liked what he did against OKC in that series and pushing them to the brink and the different coverages. It just is really tough. You know, as a chef, you can't make a Michelin star meal without Michelin star ingredients. And sometimes with Adelman, it looked like he was really searching for options when Michael Porter Jr. couldn't move his arm above his shoulder, and you're dealing with Russell Westbrook. And at this stage of his career, at this point in the season, it's not in the cards. And so it's good to see that he gets the extension here, but it is confusing who's running the show there in Denver. They had Tim Connelly. They let him go over to Minnesota, and you see what they're doing now. And then, of course, Calvin Booth got let go too. And you're seeing Kroenke talking about this hire and the future of the franchise. Very interesting, that void, the power void there in Denver. And I wonder how they move forward with Adelman in that front office structure.
Tom, I talked about the Knicks and the Pacers with Jonathan from Knicks Film School, who was very sad and very nice to join me on the pod today to talk about that. But real quick, I did want to ask you, any takeaways from that insane, nuts, crazy game one? How are you feeling about that series after that?
Dude, I don't know about you, but I think the Pacers have changed the way I watch basketball. If it's a 10-point deficit with like a minute left, I'm like locked in, dude.
I felt that way tonight with Minnesota. Yes. Like, they're down 10. I'm like, hey, you never know. You never know.
if you're Thibodeau, how big does the lead have to be? And this is right up Thibodeau's alley. Like, he is dreaming of this. Is like, if it's a 30-point lead with 2 minutes left, I got to keep my starters in. He has more reason now than ever to get very nervous. If he goes to the bench here, he's not going to want to take his guys out. Because, like, dude, with the Pacers, 2 minutes left in the game, how big does the lead have to be, Kev? If you're the head coach, how big does the lead have to be for you to feel confident that you're going to win that game? Because against the Pacers have three epic all-time comebacks this postseason, the last 2 weeks, over at unpredictable.com. They have tracked just the win probability, the chance of you coming back in these postseason games. Indiana has three of the top seven since 1997, and it's all happened in the last 2 weeks. Oh, it's nuts. God. It's crazy. They changed the way I watch basketball, dude.
And if they make the finals, they're due for another one. They have won every round. They'd be due for one against OKC, but that would be the greatest challenge if they could do that against that Oklahoma City defense, the greatest challenge. But then again, the way Neesmith shot the ball, it doesn't matter what you're doing on defense. It just does not matter at all. That was a crazy game. Tom, appreciate you joining me tonight, man. Hope you have a good rest of your weekend, and everybody needs to check out the big number.
Yeah, thanks, man. Everyone have a great Memorial Day weekend and enjoy the hoops.
Enjoy it all, everybody. Thank you for joining me on today's episode. Up next, we have Jonathan from Knicks Film School, and later in the show, Asen Newell, NBA draft prospect, potential lottery pick, joins the show as well to talk about his game and his future. The Knicks blowing a 14-point lead in the final 3 minutes to lose to the Pacers in overtime at MSG. 138-135 with Jonathan from Knicks Film Room. Jonathan, sorry that you're joining me under these circumstances, but we didn't see this coming.
Kev, I think until you just said it, I was kind of hoping it was a dream. And now hearing you, who I know, you know, you're not a figment of my imagination. Yeah, I guess that did happen, didn't it? So I guess we have to talk about it.
Yeah, we'll call this like a little bit of a Knicks fan therapy session. Because we got to talk through it, man. I mean, you had a live show right after the game. Yeah. what were the feelings as they're blowing the lead throughout that end of that fourth quarter and into overtime? Like what's going on through your mind as that's happening?
So I will just say, you know, as a preface, I am the sort of fan that like, so I'll take us back to game six against Boston. They were up by, what were they up by? Like 41. They got up by 41. And I think the Celtics went on an 11-0 run to cut it to 30 with like 8 minutes to go. And I was the guy who was like, hold on, 8 minutes left. It's only a 30-point lead. So I am never the fan who relaxes. I'm never the fan who's like, this is over. And so they're coming down the stretch. And I think the closest I got with the Pacer game to being like, okay, this is over, or this is essentially over, there were two spots. It was when they went up by 17 right before a 4-0 Pacer run, and then Brunson checked back into the game. And then fast forward to when Cat makes the layup, and it was with 41 seconds left, and it was an 8-point lead. I said, okay, 8 points in under 41 seconds. I think we're okay. And then that lasted for all of, I think it was, what, 7 seconds? And then Nembhard hit the, or Nesmith, excuse me, hit the deep three. I sensed it coming, and it's not because this team has blown a lot of crunch time leads. They haven't. In fact, they had the record that, or for however many, 70-some-odd consecutive games, they didn't blow a 15-point lead. But there has been something off, and I don't need to tell you this, Kev, there has been something off about this team all season. And, you know, I feel a little silly that after games four and game six against Boston, and honestly, through the first 3.5 quarters of this game, I had convinced myself that that was behind them, that they had outgrown that. And I think what we learned in the final 2 minutes is there are some strands of this team's DNA that are just, something's a little off. Yeah.
Yeah. I think during the end of the Pistons series, beginning of the Boston series, after the, I forget when it was exactly. At some point during the playoffs, I had a conversation with somebody about, well, hey, feels like the Knicks, after a year of messing around, they finally have that grit and that toughness that it feels like they've grown out of it. And no, they haven't. How would you said I know about it, but like for people who don't know about it, how would you describe that something's off with the Knicks that's been there lingering all year long?
Well, I'll give you an example. So the Knicks start off like gangbusters. They're second in offense for the first two or so months of the season. And it looks great. Defense is obviously pretty shaky, but instantaneously it's like, oh, the Cat fit. This is great. McCall wasn't even really playing all that well out of the gate, but they had this crazy offensive rating and everything was just clicking. And then over the course of the season, they started to deteriorate into this team that was, even when they were fully healthy, they were kind of mediocre. And specifically, and I'm sure, you know, we'll probably get into this, the starting five. And then the longer it went on, you couldn't just chalk it up to, oh, this is a blip on the radar or anything. And you could go back and look at the net rating of the starting five starting on like January 1st. So more than half of the season, these guys are a negative together. And then, through that time, there was a popular sentiment, oh, this is all because centers or teams are sticking their center on Josh Hart. It has neutered the Cat Brunson pick and roll. And I think to a large extent that is true. And boy, oh boy, did we ever see that in the Pistons series and even in the Celtics series, though they kind of figured some things out. And then fast forward to last night. And Carlisle comes out. What does he do? Puts Miles Turner on Karl-Anthony Towns. Cat's eyes light up. We saw him play the sort of game. It was the highest scoring playoff game of his career. But if you watch that game closely, it wasn't that Brunson and Towns were getting a lot off of each other. It was almost more like Katzka, I'm going to do my thing. Brunson, I'm going to do my thing. And both of them individually put up great stat lines. But I don't know, did you feel watching that game like all of a sudden there was this synergy between New York's two best players? Because I know watching, I didn't feel that way. And that to me is just like a little sign that like something is not quite right in the mix.
Yeah, it's a lot of your turn, my turn. between them.
Absolutely.
Is the way it feels. It's like, I mean, you would think on paper, this would be a dynamic duo, similar to like the idea of, you know, Giannis and Damian Lillard or Jalen Brunson and Karl Anthony Towns. It's like, oh my goodness, on paper, these two guys are going to have amazing two-man actions, amazing chemistry, especially because Kat can pass a little bit and handle a little bit. There's just so many ways that you dream up how those guys could play together. But it just feels like a lot of your turn, my turn. And I would just wonder how much of that is a Brunson thing, because with Brunson, he's, you know, a guy who runs a lot of pick and roll, has the ball on his hands a lot. And I'm not saying he's a negative passer. He's not. He can facilitate. He can play make. But he's not throwing many lobs to Mitchell Robinson. There are some limitations with him when it comes to playing off of the ball as well. Luka, same thing with Dallas back in the day between Luka and Jalen Brunson. I used to think it was an entirely a Luka problem. Maybe it was a little bit of a Brunson issue as well, between how with them it was a your turn, my turn thing as well. So I think ultimately, like you're talking about that Knicks starting five, you know, they get smoked on defense. What was it? They had a 167 defensive rating, or like between the starting five and the game on game one. Insane. Like, it's an absurd, unbelievable number.
I looked at Pivot Fade earlier today, and because it allows you to group by like 2-man, 3-man, 4-man. The starting lineup defensive rating was atrocious, but as will surprise probably nobody, the worst individual 2-man defensive rating of the starting five was with Brunson and Towns, which I looked at it. I think it was 162. And then look, all the numbers are bad, but then you go and you look at like, it's disgusting. But then you go look at like Deuce and Cat. And now, granted, we're talking about a sample size of 13 minutes, but I think it was like a 50-something defensive rate. I mean, it's absurd. Again, small sample size theater. But it just goes to show, and again, it gets back to this larger kind of theme of the season and this team. There are combinations that work really well with this team. Like, you brought up Mitch before. I admit Brunson is not the best lob thrower, but ever since Mitch has come back, it's like, oh, wait a minute, there's the Brunson that we kind of saw more of in last season or last postseason, where he's much more comfortable operating in the pick and roll. Mitch is a great screen partner for him, and the numbers in the playoffs back that up. And then you got, like, all season long, Kat with the backup unit. Like, Kat and Campaign, those guys, I mean, you would think they're Steph Curry and Draymond Green with the offensive rating. It's a joke, but like, go look at the numbers from this year. Those guys killed teams. And then you throw in Deuce in the mix. So there's stuff that works here, but there's something about this five-man unit that it's not adding up, Kevin.
Caitlin Cooper, great Pacers podcaster, made a post, I think it was this morning. I rewatched the game after with this in mind. She posted, the Knicks subbed Robinson in for defense during overtime, and then the Pacers countered with inverted spacing. She wrote, started running actions that involved the guards in the middle of the floor, targeting Brunson with bigs in the corner. Closing this game was about shape-shifting in addition to shot-making for the Pacers. You mentioned that two-man combination with Kat and Brunson. Things changed when Robinson came on the floor. Do you expect Thibodeau to make any rotation changes, any tactical changes? Like, what comes to mind when it comes to, like, what are the things that can be improved upon seeing the way the Pacers change the way they played throughout the game? Like, from a substance point of view, not an emotional point of view. Sure. Like, is there anything that comes to mind here?
So, a couple things. One, I think we saw early on in this game that, you know, and look, this is not a one game issue. Obviously, this has been a 10-year issue with Karl Anthony Towns. If you are going to put Kat in drop, the odds are that things are going to go poorly. So I would suspect that when Brunson and Kat share the floor, they are going to lean into a little bit more switching. Obviously, that was the story of the Boston series. They both switched a little bit last night. And when they switched, I thought, by and large, not every time, but it worked pretty well. And you know what? Even when the Pacers make shots in those situations, they're the shots you could live with. Because like everybody, you know, my colleague Benji Ritholtz says, you know, you want to stay out of the blender. Because once the Pacers get you in the blender, that's where they kill you. So at least if you're switching, you have at least a better chance of staying out of the blender. So I think that's something that he could do. You know, as far as Mitchell Robinson is concerned, you know, he played, I think it was somewhere in the low 20s in terms of minutes last night. we got an extended look of the double big lineup in the fourth quarter. It's when Brunson went to the bench with his fifth foul. They went on that 14-0 run. It was going to be the story of the game. I guess my only thing in terms of like drastic changes is up until, I mean, really, let's call a spade a spade. Up until Brunson comes back in that game with 5 minutes left, you look at the total picture. They were up by 13 points. They had scored at a good enough clip. And I think they had only given up 94 points at that moment, maybe 98 points. Maybe it was 98 points. So like Pacers offense, I think that's like they were doing enough. You know, it wasn't perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but they were doing enough. And that's why for me, it's tough for me to disentangle my focus on the larger systemic issues that maybe come from that game and just about not closing it out. And that's where the big, real responsibility lies.
I mean, look, they scored 9 points final 3 minutes and 30 seconds or so. Like, that should be enough to win the game. It just so happens that Aris Nesmith went absolutely nuclear. I mean, like, they scored 23. It's just like they did. It feels like what should have been enough offensively to close out the game. It's just they were scoring literally every time down, no matter the defense. And I know the Knicks made some mistakes as well. They missed 2 free throws when they're following up 3. By the final minute, OG missed 1. Cat missed 1. There's a turnover, and like there's mistakes in overtime as well. There's defensive mistakes in OT especially. But like if Nesmith doesn't turn into Reggie Miller, this is a Knicks win up 1-0. Like the fact is, like with Nesmith, if I were a Knicks fan, the shot that would bother me the most was the 6-3. And it's not because it was the sixth in a row. It was because the fifth one he hit with 34 seconds on the clock. After that, there's a timeout and there's a review. It was 7 minutes and 45 seconds later in real time between the fifth one and the sixth one. It's like, you're still this hot? You're still this hot after all this time? I mean, review and a timeout and you're still scorching hot? Stop it.
If I'm gonna rank them, man, talk about a painful freaking exercise. No, I mean, like, but look,
ranking the pain of the Nesmith threes.
Ranking the pain. If I ever write a Knicks book, that's going to be the name of it. no, but like, but like, yes, did he go off? Absolutely, he went off. And yet, the first, not counting one he hit, I think in the middle of the quarter, the first one of like that closing stretch. What happened? Nesmith comes around the screen, and it's in front of Karl Anthony Towns. And I want to say out front, Karl Anthony Towns made some big-time defensive plays, in particular in the fourth quarter of this game. He did a lot of good stuff on switches, even not on switches. I think he showed up, and to say nothing of his offensive performance. But Nesmith comes around the screen, and there's Karl in drop coverage, you know, 3-4 feet off of him. And that's the three, you know, on the left wing there that really gets him going. And then you look at a few more, and there's OG Anunoby, and like, look, I feel bad OG didn't make an all-defense team today. He finished, you know, one spot out of the second team. I think he deserved to make it. But, like, the fact is that OG has had some moments throughout this year, and there was 2 instances. Now, one of them, I think he thought Towns should have – I'm not exactly sure what he thought Towns should have done differently, but either way, OG is receding, you know, into the paint, and Nesmith – pulls up. And he did that twice. I just, you know, that's your best defender. That's the matchup you want. And for it to happen on his watch, I think that's for me what kind of probably makes it the most painful. And the Brunson turnover.
What's been the sense of Knicks fans today? Like, obviously last night, I'm sure it's a lot of anger or frustration, but is it just carried on into the day after?
I didn't want to think about it all day today. I'm just going to be honest with you. Like, I wear my heart on my sleeve with this stuff. Like, there's, you know, a video going around of me crying after Game 6 of the Boston game, like a little baby. Cause I'm like, this is what we do this for. You know, I've got really emotional, and this was just, I mean, talk about the complete opposite. I think there's a lot of anger, and I think there's a lot of, and it's happened with every loss this postseason. And I know maybe people haven't paid that close attention to the Knicks, but every, like, Game 2 against Detroit, Game 5 against Detroit, just no-show jobs. Like, they just didn't show up. And both of those games were at home. Game 3, the most excited the Garden has been in 25 years. no show, did not show up. And then game five at Boston was like, you had a chance to close out, you didn't, but it was in Boston, you could forgive that one. And I think all of these, after every one of these losses, despite the fact that the Knicks were at least tied in the series every time, fans, you know, it brought up a lot of the frustrations from this year. And I know that probably sounds crazy to some of your listeners, because it's like, wait a minute, the Knicks stunk forever. They won 51 games this year. They're going to have two All-NBA players. But there was something about this year where you watched this team, if you were a fan, and you sensed in your gut, this is not as good as it should be. This is not as consistent as it should be. And there is something off about these guys. And I think there's been a lot of blame to go around, including on the coach. And I think what last night did was it brought out just a lot of that negativity, just speaking for myself, because this team, you know, I know they're in the conference finals. It just feels like they should be better, maybe not better, but more cohesive. And after the time that they've had, and just maybe a little bit more on the same page.
How much of that is on Tibbs? You mentioned part of it, the part of the blame goes on the coach. Like what is missing there? What can Tibbs be doing that he hasn't been doing?
I'm an unabashed supporter of Tom Thibodeau, much to everyone's chagrin. I feel like I'm the one fighting the good fight sometimes, because I always want to try to pay respect to what he brought to the organization and all of that. I think for a lot of the year, and you know, I don't want to like repeat myself, but you looked at the offense, you looked at the fact that, okay, why are they not doing more to spring Cat for threes, even when he's being guarded by a small? Why aren't they running more actions for Cat? Why are they going so drastically away from the Cat Brunson two-man game? And, you know, Josh Hart obviously stayed in the starting lineup. I think as the season has gone along and as the playoffs have gone along, I've probably put less blame on him. One, because Josh Hart is a guy, maybe the only guy, who has shown up for every one of these playoff games on both ends of the floor. Not saying he's perfect, not saying he doesn't bring issues with him. He does. You know, see Luke Kornet in game five. But so it's like, if you're Tibbs, it's like, all right, I got my one guy that I know I could count on, and he's the guy I'm supposed to take out of the starting lineup. Like, I sympathize with Tibbs for that. At the same time, you know, this team has gone through offensive ruts where you're like, all right, I get it. The game tells you what to do, but maybe we need a little bit more than that here. And then I just think, if you want to just look at last night, you know, the decision to take Mitchell Robinson and Deuce McBride out of the game. Was Mitch a little gassed? Maybe. And who are you bringing in? You're bringing in the clutch player of the year. So
as if Tibbs cares if a player's gassed.
I know, exactly. I mean, he'll care if he feels like the effectiveness is waning.
Of course.
But
more of a thing than with a Josh Hart type, of course, or Mikal Bridges.
Well, I'll tell you who wasn't gassed was Deuce McBride. Now, look, Mikal Bridges he's become fourth quarter Mikal, right, in these playoffs. So he was the other guy that came in there. You know, again, you're going to tell Tom, like, no, you're the guy you just traded for five first-round picks for, who has won you multiple games in the fourth quarter of this playoffs. You're going to keep him on the bench because, you know, they're playing well with Deuce. Again, we could nitpick. At the end of the day, this is a team of veterans. They were assembled to be able to start to compete this year because these guys have all been there before. Everyone on this roster, or notable player on this roster, has made it to at least the second round. Bunch of guys, conference finals. To have a collective disintegration like that, where you're just letting go of the rope on defense, and again, you won't find a bigger Jalen Brunson fan than me. His decision to throw that pass to OG Anunoby under the basket, which, again, it's one play and nobody cares about it because Nesmith was crazy and Halliburton hit the shot. If he doesn't throw that pass, we're not having this sort of conversation right now. And I think it's a different outcome. So a little bit of frustration, needless to say.
There's a lot of poor passes, including the one that was reviewed. I think it's all blending together. The one in overtime as well, deflected out. Like, that was kind of a risky long pass. Didn't have to make it at that moment. And those are the plays where it's like, those are the plays where exactly no urgency, not feeling the moment. And also just that those are the choke plays. Choking isn't just missing a free throw or missing a shot. It's sometimes making a pass when you shouldn't make a pass. saw the clip of them on the sideline at the end of regulation where they're kind of bickering at each other. Clearly, there was a lot of infighting and they were feeling the pressure down the stretch of that entire game as Indiana storming back. And that's where, as you said, like, this is a veteran group. Like, they got to be more composed than they are in that moment. They have to be. You got to give credit to Indiana, too. As much as we're criticizing the Knicks for losing composure and making mistakes, the Pacers, their third time having this historic comeback, how do you have this amount of resilience in these moments to keep battling back and keep fighting? You hit a three. Knicks hit a three. Knicks are up four in the middle of overtime with, 2 minutes, 30 seconds, 3 minutes left, and you're still battling back. Didn't Knicks have the ball? I think when they're up four, Brunson had the layup, right? The layup.
If there's one thing I'm going to be like, we kind of got screwed a little bit. They showed the review. It was a goaltend. I think it was a pretty clear goaltend. Obviously, you can't review it. But yeah, they would have gone up by six. Instead, it was a semi-transition opportunity the other direction, and I think it ended up being a Nembhard corner three. So it was a 5-point swing, you know. But whatever, they should never have gotten to that point.
Yeah, never should have gotten there. With Halliburton, he does the Reggie Miller choke thing, and understandably so. What's going on through your mind as that's happening? Kevin, are you raging? Do you want to kill him?
Kevin, so everybody has different entry points into their fandom. Mine came in 93-94. And so that was the year of the original choke symbol. Now, the Knicks lost that game. They did win that series. Which, again, some people forget. But my true indoctrination to fandom was 8 points in 8.9 seconds. And obviously the finger roll followed about 2 weeks after that. So for me, as much as people, you want to talk about, you know, Bulls or Celtics or Heat, I mean, the Heat are a big rival. The Pacers for me were always number one. And then, you know, they had the dalliance in 2013 with that playoff series and the Hibbert block, and then fast forward to last year and that happens. I mean, the best compliment I could give Tyrese Halliburton is that he's a really easy guy to hate, because in order to hate an athlete that's playing your team, they have to be good. And that guy, you said, where do the Pacers get this resilience from? I think their team has been together for a few years, which I think we should not gloss over, but you get it from your best player, and he's their best guy. He's their leader, and they don't give up because he's never given up. Now, I think, look, you could say the same thing about Jalen Brunson. We'll see how they respond tomorrow night. I hope they respond well. We'll find out.
With the Knicks, you do mention when Reggie Miller did it, the Knicks won that series. This is just a game one. Do you like? But the way you're talking about this team, Jonathan, is like, you've saw part aspects of this coming, where it was like this all year long, where this is these bad habits coming back and this gut feeling that something's off. After this happens in game one, the way it's happened, like, where's your faith level that the Knicks can actually win this series like they did three decades ago when they beat Reggie Miller?
Well, it is only a game one, and I do not doubt their mental fortitude to come back and as much as any team is able to do, put this behind them. The reason why I have some serious doubts is because I think I don't want to speak for any Knicks fans, but like I think there were some in the Knicks fan base that maybe did not have the level of respect for Indiana that I had. Now, we had a couple of people here at Knicks Film School that actually picked the Pacers to win the series, so it's not on our end. They're just such a good basketball team. And if you spot them a game that you have, it's less about, can the Knicks come back and play well? Can the Knicks make the tactical changes? Can they figure out the defensive stuff? It's more like you gave them one of your wins. And so now you have to not only get back that win, but you have to get three additional wins, you know? And that's, I mean, it's just a tall order. I wouldn't put it past them, Kevin, but if you're asking me right now, I picked the Knicks at 7 before the series. If you're asking me right now, do I believe that they're going to win? I sadly would say no, and I hope every Knicks fan throws that right back in my face. 2 weeks from now if they end up winning the series. I would love nothing more. Nothing would make me happier.
I mean, look, I think you nailed it right there. I picked the Knicks in seven. I said it was basically a coin flip series that is going to be an epic, you know, down to the wire series. Did not see that coming in game one, of course. But ultimately, I feel with this series, you're spot on. They gave one of the coin flip games away. They had a win, and they gave it away. And so it's hard to feel a lot of faith because of out of respect to Indiana, to your point.
And to say one more thing just about Indy, and the last thing I want to be doing is gushing about this team. You know, Indy's not going to give you an easy win. I mean, clearly, because you know what? Last night was probably the closest thing to it. They're not going to give you the easy win. And so you figure, you know, some series you get into and you're like, all right, there's going to be a game where team X shoots, you know, 40 whatever percent from three, and they're going to, you know, have a 15 or 20 point victory. Like, I'm not accounting for that. And I just think that the reason why I think the Pacers are so dangerous is because they could go down by 15 or 20 points. They're still going to play their style. They're still going to go out there. They're still going to play as the only way they know how. And, you know, it's almost like, you know, there's nothing more dangerous than somebody with nothing to lose. They play like they have nothing to lose. And it doesn't seem to make a difference what situation they're in. And that's just, you know what? Again, credit to them for being able to play that way. But that's part of my why I'm a little, you know, hesitant to predict the Knicks come back and win this series.
They got a hell of a coach, too. I mean, I thought his decision to roll with Obi Toppin late in that game, ballsy, risky, but it worked out. It ended up being a great decision.
Put back in overtime. Massive, absolutely massive play.
Double clutch dunk in transition. I mean, looking like a dunk contest in the middle of an overtime game.
And look, if you...
It got fouled as well.
It did get fouled. They got very lucky there. It didn't end up mattering. Look, I never was on board with the whole train of like OB should be starting over Julius Randle or anything like that. But it was very clear that there was always a good player in there. And I think if you want to, you know, talk about the difference between Carlisle and Tibbs. Now, look, this has not always been Carlisle. I believe there's a Rajon Rondo footnote here somewhere. So it's not like Carlisle has taken every player that has come his way and just melded to fit like, you know, what they're great at. But he is sure making the best out of Toppin, in part because this is the style that his team plays with and it's how his point guard wants to play. But Thibodeau was never able to really get the most out of Toppin because it was always more about fitting, you know, the square peg into the round hole. And if you're going to play for Tibbs, you got to be a Tibbs guy. And that's, if there's going to be a knock on him, I think that's at this point in his career, I got to think that that's the biggest one.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say with Tibbs. And last thing on Halliburton here, 31 points, 12 of 23 in the game, 11 assists, only two turnovers. It's funny, like when the Pacers are down 14 late in the game, Halliburton's sitting at 18 shots. And in my head, I'm thinking, well, this might be the series where Halliburton has to average 20, 25 shots a game in order for Indiana to win the series. And then Neesmith gets hot. Halliburton makes big plays, hits big shots down the stretch. And it's like a reminder that he can turn it on to that level basically whenever he wants to. I mean, the fact he's been as clutch as he has been this entire season, 11 of 12 and clutch shots in the last 30 seconds, whatever the stat is, I don't have it in front of me. He is capable of reaching another level in these big moments and in these games. And so that's why, like, if Indiana advances, but even within this series, I do think there's going to have to be a moment for Halliburton, might be this round, might be next round if they advance, where he's got to take 30 shots. He has to pass a bit less and score more. And I'm feeling very increasingly confident with him that he's capable of still sustaining efficiency and having those types of games. How would you assess Halliburton as kind of like being able to raise his own ceiling in these types of games?
Well, he's absolutely able to raise his own ceiling late, and he's clearly not afraid of taking, you know, the big shot. And again, he got the bounce. Credit to him.
That bounce!
If I'm the
dude,
Knicks,
the bounce, Jonathan. I mean, God,
when it went up off the rim initially, my gut reaction was like, oh my God, we dodged the bullet. That, like, for a split, for a second there, I was like, we dodged the bullet. And then, of course, we know what happened next. I'll just say this. If I'm the Knicks, this is going to sound probably crazy. I think I want Tyrese Halliburton taking 25 to 30 shots a game. Because if he's taking 25 to 30 shots a game, that means it's probably a decent number of those are coming off a one-on-one play where he gets a switch that he likes, and he's, whether it's, you know, floater or mid-ranger or maybe a semi-contested three. And, like, look, he's capable of making a lot of shots. That goes without saying. But, again, you are keeping – like, this Pacers offense feasts because everybody eats. And I think the more you could get away from that, and again, the blender, which, again, for the most part, the Knicks, I think, actually did okay staying out of. But I don't know. Maybe that's going to sound – it probably does sound crazy. But I just know when I'm most afraid of the Pacers is when the ball's whizzing around and when Halliburton is able to make more plays as a passer than as a shooter.
And he's so good, man. Like that little scoop pass he had to, I think it was Nembhard cutting and overtime. Just, I mean, the dude's unbelievable.
Josh Hart probably should have, you know, woken up in that moment. But yeah, sure. it was a great pass. Yeah.
Yes, man. Dude, I still can't believe it. I still can't believe it. Like, you know, I saw Zach Lowe posted how a ton of beat writers had left and got gone back to the locker room and all that. I'm sure tons of people had resumed their night, started, you know, they flipped from HBO Max to Last of Us episode or whatever. You know, I'm sure like they were done. They were done. You know, like they would turn off the TV, put the kids to bed. But no, I just can't believe that actually happened. But to me, like, it does look like the Knicks lose this game in heartbreaking fashion. But the fact that it happened, right? The Knicks were on the other side of it. They had two 20-point comebacks against the Celtics, different circumstances and all that. You know, it's a second half comeback, not a final 3-minute comeback. But crazy things happen in the NBA. Crazy things happen. It is not that crazy for the Knicks to win game two on Friday night, tie series, and then win two more, and then be 3-2, whatever. Well, who knows? And then you never know. Like, it could be a game six easily, and then this feels like more of a distant memory, a bad memory, a nightmare. But, like, crazier things have happened than the Knicks winning this series is my point.
Yes. And to your point about comebacks, like, this comeback doesn't happen 30 years ago, doesn't happen 20 years ago, probably doesn't even happen 10 years ago. Like, the three-point shot was just not at the place where it is today to allow this sort of thing to happen. To your point about them getting back in the series, I said to myself before game one started, just get me a 2-2 coming back to game five. Because I felt if you got them to 2-2 coming back for game five, the Knicks would win in game five and then either win game six or bring it back for game seven. That's in my mind what I was thinking. I think they will win game two. I would actually be, I just, again, this is going to sound crazy, I would be shocked if they lost game two. And then it's about, okay, can you win one on the road? And that's where, hey, this team is now, 5-1 on the road in the postseason, I think. So clearly they are comfortable playing away from Madison Square Garden. Kev, I wouldn't put it past them. They're a resilient group. I do think they have toughness. I do think they have metal. They did not show it last night. They're very flawed, but they're also very talented. And it was not his best ending to a game. They do still have Jalen Brunson. I'm always going to bet on that more times than not. So, you know, we'll see what happens. I would love for this to be a distant nightmare more than anyone, I promise you.
I mean, look, I mean, I want to say it's better to be in this spot feeling this heartbreak than it is to be irrelevant for two decades. You want to be in these games, you want to be feeling these emotions, but at the same time, like, when you're feeling it, sometimes you'd rather not be there.
For Kev, you know what didn't come with watching or rooting for Frank Ntilikina to
Frankie, like, Smokes, baby.
Drive to score. Talk about parties we threw. When he drove to score, it was like, oh my goodness, it's happening. But you know what didn't come with that? Pain. That wasn't painful. It was frustrating. It was annoying. It was aggravating at times. It wasn't painful. So, you know, you make this deal as a sports fan, and, you know, if you get the high highs, then you got to be ready to take the low lows, and that's where we're at today.
Hey, well, I hope we get a hell of a series moving forward. It goes 6-7 games and some more epic moments, more opportunities for Halliburton to do the choke motion, or maybe Brunson to do it back to him. You never know. Can you imagine Brunson does it back to him? Like, wouldn't that be the sweetest ending?
That would be something. I don't see JB doing that. I think he's going to stick with his...
Who would be most likely Knicks player to do it? Most likely.
Oh, to do the choke?
To do the choke back to Halliburton. A reverse choke. Cat. Not a lot of guys I'd choose. It's not Cat, I don't think. It's not OG.
OG definitely wouldn't do it.
No chance.
Bridges wouldn't. I mean, like,
Josh Hart?
I mean,
campaign. I don't think. Totally would Josh be campaign. Hart,
yeah. Listen, Josh Hart had my favorite moment of the last 5 years when, I don't know if you remember, there was a game last season when Brunson went down with an injury in the first quarter against Cleveland, and the Knicks should not have won the game, and they came back and won it. And Josh Hart hit a corner three, and Donovan Mitchell was out, and he was on the sidelines. And Josh Hart hits three, turns around, and flips Donovan Mitchell's like gold chain up towards his neck, and just went up the court. Like, that's more a Josh Hart thing to do. I wouldn't see Josh Hart doing the choke to Tyrese, but I'd love to be proven wrong. Hey.
You never know. Maybe that opportunity will come down the line in the series, and it will create for a epic moment for Knicks fans to party on the streets. Who knows? Jonathan, thanks for joining me today, especially considering the circumstances after that. After that game on game one on Wednesday night. Appreciate it, man.
I appreciate you having me on, Kev. And while I'm here, I'll shout out to all my people at Knicks Film School, because I'm the one here with you, but. They have all been doing amazing work for this Knicks run. So be sure to check out them if you are interested in more Knicks trials and tribulations, as it were.
Hey, I mean, you guys do amazing stuff. You got great shows, great content literally every single day. Anybody who wants to learn about the Knicks or just learn about the Knicks Pacers series, really. Like, if you're a fan of the Pacers or just want to get in-depth basketball talk, you guys do amazing stuff, Jonathan. Appreciate what you've built, and appreciate you coming on here today, man.
Thanks so much, Kev. Appreciate it.
Big thank you to Jonathan for joining me on today's episode. Up next, we get Asa Newell, freshman out of Georgia, potential lottery pick in the 2025 NBA draft. We got into his game, his future, some fun stuff at the end of the conversation. Hope you enjoy my conversation with Asa Newell. Here with Asa Newell, projected first round pick in the 2025 NBA draft. Asa, how you doing here in Chicago, man?
I'm doing amazing. I've been having a great week here in Chicago. Weather's good. Can't complain.
I mean, the weather's beautiful outside our window right now. It's a little cloudy, but the sun's out. It feels good. It's getting warmer. Hopefully no thunderstorms as there could be, but it's feeling good right here in Chicago. It's nice. We got Lou Malnati's pizza earlier today. So good.
Haven't heard of that. I might need to try that
one. I mean, like, you're probably eating healthy at this time of year. You know, full on deep dish pizza. It's full like 3,000 calories in one meal.
Yes, sir.
But if you get a cheat meal, I highly recommend Lou Malnati's. It was delicious. For someone who has never watched Asa Newell play, how would you describe your game to them?
I'll just say I'm very fiery. Really explosive athlete, can contribute on both sides of the floor, offensive and defensively. Floor spacer, can switch on multiple positions.
Seems like you know yourself well. Who would you compare yourself to then? Like, former or current NBA players?
Former, I would say Chris Bosh. I get that comparison a lot. Lefty, can guard, shoot the three ball, and also punish small defenders.
I mean, you said shoot the three ball. That's something you shot below 30% from three this past year. Georgia, lower volume guy. Is that like the main thing you're really working on right now is three ball?
Yeah, I felt like my story wasn't told at Georgia. This summer, I've been in the gym. My shot is super consistent. And I'm really excited to showcase my skills during pro day in this pre-draft process.
So, like, when it comes to, like, talking to teams or, you know, what you read online, whatever it might be, well, what do you think is, like, most misunderstood about your game? What do people get wrong the most?
Trying to put me, you know, at the five position, I'll say I'm a four. Someone who can play with another big and also my three-point shot.
So like you view yourself as somebody who can play with another five, with a five or even five and smaller lineups, like either lineup.
Yes, sir. Very interchangeable.
Actually, and I think that's like the interesting thing about, you know, this year's playoffs have been super physical, but like you're also seeing a lot of teams use two bigs. Minnesota, obviously Gobert and Naz Reid, or Gobert and Randall, or Reid and Randall, like different combinations. The Knicks sometimes using Cat with Mitchell Robinson, the Rockets with Şengün and Adams, like up and down the line, there's a lot of teams using two bigs. Mm-hmm. So I feel like a big like you with your versatility entering the league at a perfect time. As you watch the league and you're seeing more of these like two big lineups really come back, what have been your observations of watching these playoffs and the league as a whole right now?
Well, I think that, you know, Georgia prepared me super well for this moment, and we played a two big lineup as well, and you know, just getting my feet wet under that area, and also at Montverde playing with Derek Queen, this is something I've been preparing for my whole career basically, and now I'm taking the biggest step, which is the NBA, and they're starting to come back to that. And watching the OKC game last night, and they did it as well. And, you know, it was just something I'm super excited for.
I mean, that's true. You got Chet and Hartenstein playing big minutes for them, like a lot of minutes for them. And if it's not Hartenstein, it's Jalen Williams out there as well. Like, it's just like a lot of teams are doing it. Like, bigs are needed in today's league, especially when bigs come in with skill like you. Right. Like, you do have skill. You can be a switchable big. If the shot develops, that's going to open up your game a lot. Is it necessary for you to develop a three-pointer?
I think so. In this day and age, you know, having a knockdown shot, I'll say my three-point shot is feeling very – I'm very confident in my three-point ability, and I'm really excited to showcase my ability.
Has it been, like, mechanical changes or just reps? Like, you're feeling confident in it, but, like, have any changes been made like that?
No, it's just reps, consistency, and the type of shot that I'm getting.
How would you describe yourself as a defender?
Well, I'm agile. I can block shots, rebound. On the offensive end and defensive end, and, you know, just keeping my man in front of me.
Now, I think with you, like, that's, like, to me, the number one appeal. Mm-hmm. It's like, this dude can plug into literally any team, any system, gonna bring energy, gonna bring versatility, gonna bring boards. That's, like, the number one appeal with you. With offense, like, it's the rim finishing, the athleticism, the screening, verticality, and maybe the three-pointer. Like, you're just, like, a good all-around player that can fit with really literally any team, and you're kind of late lotto, mid lotto, you know, late teens range. It's like any team I feel like works for you. Now, when it comes to like on the long term for your development, other players, you mentioned Chris Bosh is somebody people compare you to, but are your other players you watch and try to take things from their game that you want to install over time?
Well, Jaren Jackson's ability, you know, to guard multiple positions, handle the rock, you know, shoot the three ball as well. And also, I like to look at Giannis a lot, but just the way that he's getting downhill and his progression going into the league, you know, he was skinny, and now he's an NBA champion. You know, just watching his progression is something that I look forward to.
Gotta bulk up like him? Gotta get strong?
Something like that.
Develop the handle over time, right? Yep,
exactly.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's funny. Like, you ever watch, like, old Giannis videos of him when he was playing in Greece?
I haven't.
You should look him up on YouTube. There's okay. Watch like some old Giannis. It's like he was like 2 inches shorter.
Oh, for real?
And like he was skinny, like you said, but like you could still see that open floor fluidity and just the way he like euroed around people.
Right.
And the like kind of like that scoop shot he had around the rim. It was just kind of cool to see an underdeveloped Giannis kind of like knowing what he's become in the NBA. Right. Who were your favorite players growing up when you started watching the game as a kid?
Well, I was an Atlanta Hawks fan, so my dad got me a Kyle Korver jersey, and I just fell in love with him. That's why I wanted to shoot the three ball so bad. But, you know, that 2016 Hawks team with Paul Millsap, Kyle Korver, Jeff Teague, that was kind of my team growing up.
I mean, Millsap's a good example of a guy who added a three.
Yep.
Al Horford added a three.
Right.
Like, it's kind of amazing. Like, Millsap was a six-man-of-the-year type of guy in Utah, becomes an all-star. Horford's still in the NBA today at like 50 years old because he added the three.
Yeah.
It does show the value. Like right. It's kind of a theme this last decade for bigs, to your point, right?
Yes, sir.
So you've seen that with some of your favorite teams growing up with those Atlanta Hawks teams. And I saw Korver earlier today. I walked by him.
Okay.
Yeah.
There you go.
It's kind of weird. Like, I guess we were driving in our Uber. We saw Sean Livingston just sitting on like a bench on the street texting.
Yeah, it's the beehive here in Chicago. that Marriott.
I know. It's kind of crazy, like, just seeing all these faces
that
you see on TV and on social media and all that all in one place. Is it strange for you at all?
A little bit. I mean, just seeing all the GMs and scouts, you know, in the lobby and, you know, the networking that goes on here, you know, it's something incredible to see.
What 2K rating would you give yourself as a rookie?
2K. Let's see. I'll probably like a 75, you know, rookie coming in.
I think that's fair. If you could download any specific move from any player and have it in your game immediately, what would it be?
I'll just say Giannis's, you know, his ability to get to the rim and Euro and, you know, playmaking ability.
How would you describe yourself as a person in three words?
Loyal, faithful, and happy.
What's the most memorable moment so far in your career?
Going 34-0 at Montverde Academy.
Okay. I mean, that's pretty damn cool. Going undefeated, right? Was there pressure, like, towards the end of the year? You're 31, 32, 30. Was, like, does pressure mount in those moments with being undefeated?
I want to say there's pressure. We just kind of enjoyed it. And I felt like we kind of knew that we were going to do that. So that was our mindset going into Chipotle. And we didn't want to have a really relapse of our junior year, you know, losing in Geico. So we just kind of, you know, took it to the chin and won the whole thing.
What was your first encounter with basketball? What do you remember when you were young?
Going to the park and, you know, just playing pickup with my dad back in Athens, Georgia at Bishop Park.
So your dad was really who got you into the game?
Oh, yeah,
100%. Okay, I see. Yeah, and with him, like, there must be some excitement.
Oh, yeah,
with everything going on now, right?
You can't wait.
Yeah. See, I mean, the Hawks have the 13th pick. He's probably like rooting for that, I'm sure. Dang. But we'll see what happens.
Yeah, we'll see what happens.
with you, I want to ask you some random questions, Asa. What's your biggest motivator?
I say my family. You know, just being able to uplift them and support them, and you know, they're always supporting me, so I just want to give back to them.
If you have any superpower, what would it be?
I would want to fly.
Okay.
I want to fly anywhere. Go to Spain, go to Greece.
So you'd rather fly across the Atlantic instead of teleport?
Okay, there you go, teleportation. Well, I mean, I like that better.
Well, flying is a sensation.
Yeah, that's true.
You get to feel the air and all that. Teleportation is just instant.
Maybe time travel, you never know.
The time travel would be kind of cool. Would you go back to the past?
I'll probably go back to the past, see what it's like.
Or the future?
A little bit of both.
You'd want to spoil the future?
I don't know, that's some unknown.
Guess it depends if you can change it, like if it's different timelines.
That's right. Could do Back to the Future all over.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think I'd love to go back to the past. I don't know if I'd choose to go to the future, personally. I don't know. Unless I know it's like a different alternate timeline. I wouldn't want to know what my timeline is.
Yeah.
It would make me feel like it's all predetermined.
That's true.
There's no free will.
Yeah, if you go back to the past, you could change the whole timeline too.
Sure, unless it's like you're just like a bystander.
Yeah.
Like you're just like a fly on the wall and you can see everything happening.
Exactly.
That'd be pretty sick.
That would be
What would you go back to in the past? Is there like a musician you'd want to see or an event you'd want to be part of in the crowd? What would you go back to? Or a game? Who knows?
Yeah, I would want to see how Jesus walked the earth. I feel like that's something important.
It's a good one.
Seeing him, you know, give out fish and bread to 1,000 or 500 people.
It's like, this is legit.
Yeah. For real.
He really?
Yep.
Exactly. Oh my God. It's even crazier than that in the
person.
I mean, like, my answer would be I'd like want to go to a Jimi Hendrix concert.
Okay. Yeah.
That's what I'd want to do. What's your weirdest habit, Asa?
My weirdest habit. It's not really a weird habit, but I like making ice cream with my Ninja Creami. I like making protein ice cream.
I heard about those.
You got
to
get because
I'm trying to lose this belly.
Yeah.
And some YouTuber I watch, like I stole a recipe of how to cook like a healthy burrito. And he's got that same ice cream machine.
Oh, for real?
I didn't know there's such a thing as like healthy protein ice cream.
Yeah, if you just get like a Muscle Milk or any sort of protein milk, you put some gelatin in there and you stir it up, you freeze it overnight. And then you put in your Ninja Creami the next morning and it stirs it up. And it's like, perfect.
It's like what, like 200 calories or something?
200 calories, 24 grams of protein. Great late night snack.
That's crazy.
Yes, sir.
It seems like a cheat. It doesn't seem possible.
Yeah, it's a cheat. It's a cheat code.
That's crazy. So you like doing that. How long you been using that?
I actually got it for Christmas, so I've just been cranking them out.
You're probably getting like good at it, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Do you have like different flavors? You do soft serve or hard serve always?
I usually do soft serve.
I love soft serve. That's my favorite.
That's the best one. But I really been only making like cookies and cream or like straight vanilla.
Okay, so you put the ingredients chocolate. In there too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, I see. And I'll have to get one of those in my this summer as I try to get healthy like an NBA athlete. Is there any music you listen to that would surprise people?
Not really. I mean, I wouldn't say that.
I said I would go to a Hendrix concert. Like, you're not listening to Jimi Hendrix?
Nah, I'm not.
Pink Floyd? No.
Pretty standard.
Okay. All right. Like, what's your favorite artists?
I like Lil Baby, Drake.
Okay. I like some Drake.
Okay.
But I don't really know any Lil Baby, except for the song with Dua Lipa.
Okay.
I know that. I love Dua Lipa.
Yes, sir.
I love Dua. What's your biggest pet peeve?
Oh, pet peeve. This is a good one. Probably when someone's chewing with their mouth open or just like making overly like weird noises with your breath. I don't like that. Pretty weird.
You ever watch the show Black Mirror?
See, that's on Netflix, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't. I watched like a couple episodes.
There's this episode. I think it's Hang the DJ. It's called.
Mm-hmm.
And in the episode, it's like a simulation where like you would like you download an AI version of yourself, and it puts you in a simulation to find the love of your life.
Oh wow!
It's like a dating app mm-hmm. in the future. And the girl goes into this app, and she dates a guy in this simulation
mm-hmm.
where he takes sips of water. Every time he takes a sip.
Oh, man.
That's what you're talking about, yeah, right?
Like red flag right there.
And like in the show,
mm-hmm.
she gets so sick of it.
Oh, for real?
Every time like he does
Huh?
Like she thinks he's the one at first. Then every time.
Now that's,
so you saying that made me think about
that's bad news right there.
I know. You got to get rid of that person, right?
Yes, sir.
What do you do besides basketball? I mentioned Black Mirror, TV. Like, what do you do when you're not hooping?
I like fishing a little bit. In the summertime, I used to go to Coach White's house with RJ Godfrey, Jordan Key, my brother, and you know, just fish. I'm not like a professional fisher or any of that stuff, but I like fishing. I like watching TV shows, like playing a game.
What shows?
Right now, kind of been watching The 100 right now. It's about these kids who were in space, who were born in space, and on Earth there's like a bunch of radioactive stuff going on, and they got to come back and repopulate the Earth.
You should watch that episode of Black Mirror. You don't need to watch like every episode, but mm-hmm. the episode of Hang the DJ.
Okay.
I feel like we're closer to that reality.
Okay.
Than you would think.
Yeah. Hey, man, you never know.
Uploading an AI version of yourself. Would you ever do that?
I personally wouldn't.
No?
Yeah. I'd be too scared to. Never know what these AIs might come real.
I know. Seriously, right? Yeah. I know. Could download it into a robot yeah. Asa.
I'll stay away from that.
Last question for you, Asa. What do you love most about the game of basketball?
I just love the grind. Like, you know, I have a deep love for the game, getting in the gym. Just seeing the progression of being better over time. Like, looking back, you know, from my eighth grade year to my senior year to now being in a pre-draft process, it's just been, you know,
amazing process and just, you know, not taking any day for granted.
Appreciate you joining me today. So thank you, man.
Thank you so much.
Big thank you to Tom, Jonathan, and Asa for joining me on today's episode of The Kevin O'Connor Show. Give us a 5-star rating on iTunes and Spotify if you've not done so already, and a thumbs up on YouTube. It really does help us out if you do that. Thanks to Mike, Emmy, and everybody else for producing today's episode. Hope you have a great weekend. We'll be back again on Tuesday with our next episode. Looking forward to it. Enjoy all the games, everybody.